TV.
Greetings, one and all. This is Martin Zender, the world's most outspoken Bible scholar, and you are at MZTV. And I believe it was Sarah Venus. I am not sure because there was no note in the package, but I think she's the one who sent me this shirt. If it was somebody else, please let me know. If it was you, Sarah, thank you very much. If you're watching the studio cam here, you can see it. Otherwise, I'll read it for you. It says, there it is. It says, I can fix stupid, but it's going to hurt. Yeah, that's true. I can do it, and I do it on a regular basis, but it does hurt. And I have to admire the people who can take it and become unstupid. I don't think Christopher did. We haven't heard from him. Came in here saying that I had it wrong on human free will. And I'm still in the business of going through the highlights of his verses. I'll look them over. I already shared one with you yesterday when Jesus laments over Jerusalem and saying that I would gather you, but you would not. And Christopher thinks that you would not, which Jesus says to Israel, is proof. Proof of what? It's just proof that they would not. He thinks it's proof that God's lost control of his universe. Somehow takes comfort in that. It's not proof of any such thing. As we learned yesterday concerning the absolute and the relative perspectives, and I appreciate your comments, my explanation was extremely helpful to you. I do think I kind of nailed it there. In that passage where Jesus is lamenting over Jerusalem, we're just simply describing what's happening on the stage. But I'm going to say something very helpful now. The one question you continually need to ask, especially ask this of someone who keeps bringing up verses like this, keeps showing you action on the stage, like, see, it says there, Pharaoh hardened his heart. See, it says there, Jesus said to Jerusalem, I would gather you, but you would not. See, you only need to ask one question, and that is, why? Your detractors will have no answer. The question is, why was Jerusalem unresponsive to the Lord? Why did Pharaoh harden his heart? Jesus says, come to me, all you who are heavy laden. Why do some come to him and some not come to him? I mean, even in the Gospels, you can find the answer. Jesus said, you have not chosen me, I have chosen you. But as soon as you ask, well, why? You throw them for a loop. Look, here's a vessel of dishonor. Yes, but why? Why is that person a vessel of dishonor? They have no answer. They have no answer. But the beautiful thing is, we have the answer. The answer is because God is operating all. Because God is the potter and humanity is the clay. Because God gives to all life and breath and all. Because God hardened Israel. Because God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Because God made everyone the way they are. And he causes everyone to live and move and breathe. It is so simple. And the why question takes you directly to the absolute viewpoint. And again, all these little free will minions, all they're doing, trying to prove their grandiose case of human sovereignty, all they're doing is pointing at action on the stage. Look at that. Whoa, wow, yeah, look at that. Oh, yeah, you're right, boy. Pharaoh hardened his heart. Yes, sir. Oh, Jerusalem sure did refuse Christ. Yes, sir. Oh, look at Jesus Christ knocking. Some people are opening, some people aren't. Wow, how about that? How about that? Hey, why are some doing that and others not? Look them right in the eye and ask them why. Maybe because if you pushed them up against the wall, they would have to say, well, God. That's right. And then you can explain to them the absolute and the relative. No one denies, especially not me, I would never deny that humans act. Humans have wills. Humans do things. Humans make choices. Jesus gives humans choices. Paul gives humans choices. Every Old Testament prophet gave humans choices. So, what did these choices cause the people to do? Well, to choose one way or the other. Yes. Some chose the good path. Yes. Why? Some chose the bad path. Yes. Why? Then what is the purpose for the exhortations in the scriptures? For people to do things, do right things, turn away from wrong things. The free will minions, the little ratty-toothed bottom feeders, they are convinced it's because, well, God's giving humanity, God's giving me an opportunity to show him what I can do apart from his influence. No, that's what they think. They're wrong. I can fix stupid, but it's going to hurt. Truth is that these exhortations give God the opportunity to show what he can do through humanity. He is making himself known through the human race. This is the realization that the little bottom feeders don't understand, because they think that this creation exists for them to glorify themselves. Boy, are they wrong. Boy, are they wrong. And they're going to find out how wrong they were at the Great White Throne. I'm trying to help them now, but they run away. That's what the darkness does when the light shines. So, you know, Martin Luther had a great dispute with another reformer named Huldrych Zwingli. They agreed on a lot. They were both part of the Reformation. They both hated the Catholic Church, but Martin Luther didn't quite turn away from the Catholic Church completely. When it came to the lack of human free will, Martin Luther was pretty smart, but when it came to transubstantiation, he could not let it go that bread was the body of Christ. And Zwingli and Luther had a tremendous disagreement over this. I mean, this was the clash of the titans, Luther and Zwingli. And legend has it that Luther, quoting the Lord at the Last Supper, thundered, "This is my body." And he put the emphasis on the word is, and his belly rolled and his jowls jowled around, and he spilled a giant flagon of beer as he said, "This is my body," not realizing that the is in a metaphor, which is what that is. This is my body. It's a metaphor, like all flesh is grass and we are the circumcision. All metaphors, in a metaphor, there is always the verb to be. Yes, the cupola of Admiral's Revelation 2 days ago is the verb to be. It's always in the middle of two nouns. And it's the only, this is the funny part, the tragic part, the part that makes Luther today look like an idiot on this topic, and Zwingli was absolutely right. It does not turn, the bread does not miraculously turn into the actual body of Christ. But that is what you would believe if you are not familiar with the law of language of the metaphor, or that what I explained yesterday, this word is only needed when a statement is figurative or relative. And again, as I said yesterday, is the most supplied word in all of translating, because most of the time it doesn't exist in the text. Because most of the time in the text, people are stating facts, facts, facts. This is my wife. This is Capernaum. You don't need the is when you're stating a fact. It's only when you're being relative, when you're stating something that is derivative, that comes out of something else, do you require the presence of the word is or any other form of the verb to be, such as are or was. Luther didn't know that. This is the body of Christ. Oh boy, and the word he was spitting out of his mouth was the only figurative word in the metaphor construction. The metaphor consists of two nouns on either side of the verb to be. The two nouns are always literal in metaphoric construction. Always literal. The bread was literal. The bread that Jesus was holding up was literal. And his body was literal. The only figurative part is the verb is. The bread is not literally Jesus Christ's body. It represents Jesus Christ's body. And oh, if Jesus had only said, you know, fellas, this bread is a lot like my body. If only he had employed the simile instead of the metaphor, then the simpleton, Martin Luther, would have understood that, oh, it's not really his body. Okay. It's like my body. But that's exactly what the metaphor means. But it just is a more, let's just say, it's a stronger way of stating it. Because you're getting rid of the like and you're just saying it is that thing. Well, it's a very powerful tool to have in writing, poetry. My love is a font of water springing forth from on high. It is? No, it's a metaphor. Okay, there's that. Oh, this also helps when you're studying the second death. And you get to Revelation 20:14. This is the second death, the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Second death is the lake of fire. The is present. Oh boy, if people understood what that meant, it's a freaking metaphor. Therefore, the death is literal and the fire is literal. Not many people realize that, but I know that the fire of the lake of fire is literal. People laugh at me. Ha ha. Well, don't laugh, because I'm following a law of language and you will see that the fire is literal. But I don't understand. Here we go again with that. But why would God? Here we go again with that. Doesn't matter how, doesn't matter why, doesn't matter that it doesn't fit anyone's idea of how things should be or how they would do things if they were God. Doesn't matter. Law of language says we have a metaphor. Two nouns on either side of the verb to be that appears in the text. And there are other signs that that particular verse is a metaphor. Highly technical. When a pronoun is substituted for the noun, it changes gender. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. That's not my purpose, but there's more to it than that. But it's obviously a metaphor. The death is literal. Some people think, get this, some people think the second death is figurative. They think it's not really death. They think it's a place of processing and development. They think it's like a reform school, a divine reform school. Because the fire is God, don't you know? There's another metaphor. God is fire. Anything that says like God is love, God is fire, God is this, God is that, it's all a metaphor. Unless God is spirit. Well, how do you know that's not a metaphor? Because he is not there. I showed that to you yesterday. If you don't know what I'm talking about, watch yesterday's video. You will be amazed. All right, I'm sorry, but I have to say something. Please, and I am dead serious about this. Someone, please talk to Clyde Pilkington. He made another video, this time from his office. And the video is called something to the effect that grace cannot possibly mean the unmerited favor of God. Clyde thinks he has once again happened upon a new breakthrough revelation. And in this video, he is laughing and cackling like he just discovered plutonium. It is cringeworthy and it's embarrassing because I can see right to the mistake he is making. And I explained that to you on another video. And you would think that if Clyde were to get wind of that, he would stop saying that grace does not mean unmerited favor, because that is exactly what it does mean. Grace, in fact, is favor and not based on merit. That's probably a better way of saying it. Unmerited. Not based on merit. That's exactly what it is. Clyde thinks it means joy, because joy is the English element, but you cannot define a word. As I explained a couple weeks ago, you cannot define a word by the English element, and I proved that, and you can find that in a video a couple weeks ago. But Clyde has doubled down. Well, Martin, why has he doubled down? Because he does not listen to correction. He has become arrogant. He describes himself as a man on the wall, like Nehemiah was on the wall rebuilding Jerusalem, and some people wanted to talk to him. Clyde was asked, how do you withstand the criticism of your teachings? He compared himself to Nehemiah on the wall, and some people in the text of Nehemiah wanted to come see Nehemiah, and Nehemiah said, I can't come down from this important work to talk to you. And that's exactly the attitude of Mr. Pilkington. And as I explained to you before on the topic of marriage, he made a huge mistake of overplaying the metaphor in Ephesians 5, where husbands are compared to Christ and wives to the ecclesia. And I've read to you the rule of metaphoric construction, which Clyde runs over. He doesn't know what it is. Doesn't understand it. Not that he doesn't understand it. He doesn't know it exists. And so he runs over the metaphor. And he gave a talk back in the day, as I've told you before, listing every aspect of what Christ is. And he says, that's the husbands. And every aspect of what the ecclesia is. And said, that's the wives. And he said, the wives, therefore, they're the sinners. Wives are the failers. Wives are the beneficiaries of love, never the ones who love. Wives are the resistant, and wives are the inconsistent. So he shamed all wives, shamed them by overstepping the bounds of the metaphor, which in an analogy, a metaphor, anything like that, any figure of speech, any figure of likeness, there is only one point of contact, only one. And the point of contact in Ephesians 5 is that husbands are not to abuse their wives. They're to love their wives as their own bodies. Paul says that in the context. But Clyde ignores that because he thinks he found a new meaning of love. Honest to God, I swear, I know the man. He wrote a book on this called Wife Loving. He thinks he discovered a new definition of love. Love is now something different than it was in the Old Testament. It's been expanded upon. By who? By Clyde. Because he has run roughshod over the metaphor. And he wrote a book on it, Wife Loving. And I've written a book to go against it, to teach against it, because it's hideous. And it will cause husbands to be just discouraged, and it will make wives feel like absolute total failures. My book is called How to Love Anyone. And that's a big part of the book, is teaching against this false idea that Paul is teaching a new kind of love in Ephesians. No, it's the same old love. It's agape love. It's just that Jesus Christ is the latest, greatest example of it. He was much stronger than the body. Get it? Christ, the body of Christ, a husband, love your wife as your own body. Get it? Christ could have destroyed the ecclesia, but he cherished it. Thus, you husbands, though you are much stronger than your wives, don't destroy them. Cherish them like your own body. Feed them. Keep them warm, keep them dry, love them, cherish them. That's it. But Clyde makes it into this monumental new kind of love where husbands are to sacrifice everything, just like Christ sacrificed everything. Goes too far. I tried to correct him. I tried to talk to him, but he's too proud these days to hear it. Won't even hear it. And now it's happening again. It's happening again. Now he has a brand new definition of grace. Grace no longer means unmerited favor. But let me tell you, that is exactly what grace means. And he looks at three contexts in this video he made recently. And he says that these contexts prove that grace cannot mean the unmerited favor of God. Somebody, please, this is what I would like you to do. Because if you care about Clyde at all, if you love Clyde, stop him now, because he's about to do a study Bible. And again, he's cackling and laughing maniacally in this video. It's quite disturbing because he acts like he's discovered plutonium. He's got this new revelation, and his followers are so excited that they have a new revelation. And like I told you before, Dean Wilkinson and Steve Martin and Chris Carnahan, it's all cool and wow and exciting and super exciting and awesome and neato, keen. But it's wrong. His first reference is, I'll tell you what I want you to do when you talk to Clyde, but his first reference is Luke chapter 2, verse 40. And I talked about this before, but it didn't get to Clyde because 3 days ago, he published this video. And he's doubling down on everything. Luke 2:40, the grace of God was on the boy, Jesus. The grace of God was on him, the grace. Grace was on Christ. The grace of God was on Christ. And Clyde says, he says that proves that grace can't mean unmerited favor, because if anybody, this is the mistake he's making. He's thinking, well, if anybody would merit the favor of God, it would be Christ. That's the way he's looking at it. And in this video, he's changing, he's substituting words. He substitutes unworthy for unmerited. And he substitutes doesn't deserve. So to him, it's ludicrous because he thinks that grace is a merit-based system. This is what he believes today, that it's merit-based, that we merit it. Okay, so if it is a merit-based system, then certainly Christ merited it. So if the grace of God is on Christ, doesn't that prove that it can't be unmerited favor? Because if anybody would merit it, certainly it would be Christ. Here's the point. Here's the mistake. Somebody needs to tell Clyde this, and I'll tell you how to explain it to him. You just can't mention my name. You can't. The point he's missing is that grace is favor that is not based on merit. It's therefore unmerited. It doesn't come. The favor of God doesn't come because anyone merits it, not even Jesus Christ. Do you think God favored Christ because God watched Christ and monitored him? And once he finally saw that Jesus Christ was doing everything right, God could tell himself, okay, now he's merited it, so now I will favor him. No, because it is the unmerited favor of God, and that applies to Christ as well. I think if Clyde could understand it as not based on merit, but see, he substitutes unworthy. He says, are we saying Christ was unworthy? That's what you people who believe grace is the unmerited favor of God think that grace means. No, it doesn't mean you're unworthy. I mean, you are unworthy. Christ was worthy, but worthiness or unworthiness don't even come into the picture when we're dealing with something that comes pure and straight out of God that is not based on merit, either perfect merit or 10,000 demerits. It's not based on merit. Therefore, it's unmerited. Therefore, it can apply to Christ. But Clyde says, and this is the verse he used, this is the main verse, he's insulted that anyone could possibly say that the unmerited, that the unmerited favor of God could fall upon Christ, because he's making a leap of logic. He's not deducing correctly. He's not interpreting properly here, because he's assuming that means that if grace is unmerited favor, then we'd have to say that Christ didn't merit it. And how can you say that Christ didn't merit? Of course Christ merited it. But again, it's not based on merit. Someone needs to ask Clyde this. Please, don't mention my name. If you mention my name, Clyde will throw it out automatically, because I go to a file, the troublemaker file, the problem child file. I know that. Clyde told me that years ago. I'm now forwarding your emails into a troublemaker file. He's not listening to me anymore. So somebody go up to Clyde and ask him this. Did God love Christ because Christ was worthy? Someone please ask him this. Did God love Christ because Christ was worthy? You know what? I think he would have to really pause on that. And I think he would have to say, well, no, because God's love isn't based on, God didn't love Christ because he was a good boy, because he did everything right. That's not why God loved him. Well, why did God love Christ? Because agape doesn't consider how worthy anyone is, whether they're super worthy like Jesus Christ or unworthy like Saul the Pharisee, doesn't consider it. Like the sunshine doesn't consider whether you're good or evil, falls on the good and the wicked alike. The sunshine does it not? The good and the wicked alike, because it doesn't base its solar favors upon anyone's worthiness. Therefore, the sun is the unmerited life from God. Love, the Greek word agape, is affection not based on worthiness. So God loved Christ because God is love. Not because Christ was worthy, even though if it were based on worthy, he would be the worthiest of all. Likewise, charis, the Greek word charis, while agape, love, and these are similar things, agape and charis. Agape is affection. This has all come purely from God. Agape is affection that is not based on worthiness. And charis, translated grace, is favor not based on merit. This is solid. What I'm telling you is solid, and you can find it in every single context, even Luke chapter 2, verse 40, that the grace of God, the favor of God was on Christ, and Christ didn't get it because he merited it. He got it because God favors, because it is something that initiates in the bosom of God. And it's not based on how people treat him.
Did God love Christ because Christ was lovable? Of course not. And neither did God shower him with grace because Christ merited it. Both love and grace originate purely from the Father. No amount of merit or worthiness can earn it, and no amount of demerit or unworthiness can stay its power. This, again, is because both love and grace are gifts of God, neither of which consider the lovableness, worthiness, or merit of the recipient.
Agape is affection, charis is favor. And it's, so if someone asks Clyde, maybe you ought to think about this before you do up a whole study Bible on this topic. Maybe you should think about this. Before you create an entirely new movement based on grace is no longer unmerited favor. So the thing is, he no longer has a word for unmerited favor. Clyde says grace, charis means joy. But this overlaps another Greek word, chara, separate Greek word, a different noun, which actually means joy. So now he has taken away unmerited favor and he hasn't replaced it with anything. So there's no longer a word in the Greek for unmerited favor. Because with this new vocabulary of Clyde, he's redefined the one word that does indeed mean favor not based on merit. He's taken that away, made that word to mean joy, and so there's no longer a word for unmerited favor. And in fact, Clyde ends this video by saying, God's attention to us is not unmerited. That's what he said. God's attention to us is not unmerited. What does that tell you? He thinks it's merited. That's the new teaching. We merit it. This is a heinous teaching. It's a big mistake. And quickly, he has two other verses where we are giving grace to God, and Paul is giving grace to Christ. But these contexts, again, Clyde says, how ludicrous is it to think that we are giving grace to God? But it's not. In fact, it proves my point. It proves the true definition. We are giving grace to God, not because God is worthy, even though he is. It's just that because he's God. Because he's God. We're not basing it on whether God does nice things to us or bad things to us. We show him favor. We favor him, not based upon, again, whether he's good to us or bad to us, just because he's God. That proves my point. But again, Clyde chokes on it because he thinks he gets it confused with someone being the object of it being unworthy. And it's a mixed up mess. And somebody, please, for the love of God and the love of the truth, someone, please talk to Clyde Pilkington.